Do not fold, spin, or mutilate this program. Visigoth's Grassy Knoll continues.
Well, this is part two of Orwell's essay on James Burnham and the Managerial Revolution. It appeared in New English Weekly, May 1946. And the highlight for me, one of them, from part one, is this one excerpt. What Burnham is mainly concerned to show is that a democratic society has never existed, and so far as we can see, never will exist. Society is that is of its nature oligarchical, and the power of the oligarchy always rests upon force and fraud. Burnham does not deny that good motives may operate in private life, but he maintains that politics consists of the struggle for power and nothing else. All historical changes finally boil down to the replacement of one ruling class by another. All talk about democracy, liberty, equality, fraternity, all revolutionary movements, all visions of utopia, or the classless society, or the kingdom of heaven on earth, are humbug, covering the ambitions of some new class which is elbowing its way into power. Amen to that. That's it. World history in 30 seconds. Now we're going to move on to part two. Burnham's earlier prophecy of a German victory in the war and the integration of Europe around the German nucleus was falsified, not only in its main outlines, but in some important details. Burnham insists all the way through that managerialism is not only more efficient than capitalist democracy or Marxian socialism, but also more acceptable to the masses. The slogans of democracy and national self-determination, he says, no longer have any mass appeal. Managerialism, on the other hand, can rouse enthusiasm, produce intelligible war aims, establish fifth columns everywhere, and inspire its soldiers with a fanatical morale. The fanaticism of the Germans, as against the apathy or indifference of the British and French, etc., is much emphasized, and Nazism is represented as a revolutionary force sweeping across Europe and spreading its philosophies by contagion. Yep, and they landed here. The Nazi fifth columns cannot be wiped out, and the democratic nations are quite incapable of projecting any settlement which the German or other European masses would prefer to the new order. In any case, the democracies can only defeat Germany if they go still further along the managerial road than Germany has yet gone. The germ of truth in all this is that the smaller European states, demoralized by the chaos and stagnation of the pre-war years, collapse rather more quickly than they need have done, and might conceivably have accepted the new order if the Germans had kept some of their promises. But the actual experience of German rule aroused almost at once such a fury of hatred and vindictiveness as the world has seldom seen. After about the beginning of 1941, there was hardly any need of a positive war aim, since getting rid of the Germans was a sufficient objective. The question of morale and its relation to national solidarity is a nebulous one, and the evidence can be so manipulated as to prove almost anything. But if one goes by the proportion of prisoners to other casualties and the amount of Quislingism, or traitorism, the totalitarian states come out of the comparison worse than the democracies. Hundreds of thousands of Russians appear to have gone over to the Germans during the course of the war, while comparable numbers of Germans and Italians had gone over to the Allies before the war started. The corresponding number of American or British renegades would have amounted to a few score. As an example of the inability of capitalist ideologies to enlist support, Burnham cites, and this is a quote, "the complete failure of voluntary military recruiting in England, as well as the entire British Empire, and in the United States." One would gather from this that the armies of the totalitarian states were manned by volunteers. Actually, no totalitarian state has ever so much as considered voluntary recruitment for any purpose, nor throughout history. Has a large army ever been raised by voluntary means? And under note 2, it says, "It is not worth listing the many similar arguments that Burnham puts forward. The point is that he assumes that the Germans must win the propaganda war as well as the military one, and that at any rate in Europe, this estimate was not borne out by events." It will be seen that Burnham's predictions have not merely, when they were verifiable, turned out to be wrong, but that they have sometimes contradicted one another in a sensational way. It is this last fact that is significant. Political predictions are usually wrong because they are usually based on wish thinking, but they can have symptomatic value, especially when they change abruptly. Often the revealing factor is the date at which they are made. Dating Burnham's various writings as accurately as can be done from internal evidence, and then noting what events they coincided with, we find the following relationships. In a supplementary note, added to the English edition of the book, Burnham appears to assume that the USSR is already beaten and the splitting up process is about to begin. This was published in the spring of 1942 and presumably written at the end of 1941, i.e., when the Germans were in the suburbs of Moscow. The prediction that Russia would gang up with Japan, against the USA was written early in 1944, soon after the conclusion of a new Russo-Japanese treaty. The prophecy of Russian world conquest was written in the winter of 1944, when the Russians were advancing rapidly in Eastern Europe, while the Western Allies were still held up in Italy and northern France. It will be seen that at each point, Burnham is predicting a continuation of the thing that is happening. Now, the tendency to do this is not simply a bad habit, like inaccuracy or exaggeration, which one can correct by taking thought. It is a major mental disease, and its roots lie partly in cowardice and partly in the worship or power, which is not fully separable from cowardice. Since, suppose in 1940 you had taken a Gallup poll in England on the question, will Germany win the war? You would have found, curiously enough, that the group answering yes contained a far higher percentage of intelligent people, people with IQs of over 120, shall we say, than the group answering no. The same would have held good in the middle of 1942. In this case, the figures would not have been so striking. But if you had made the question, will the Germans capture Alexandria, or will the Japanese be able to hold on to the territories they have captured, then once again there would have been a very marked tendency for intelligence to concentrate in the yes group. In every case, the less gifted person would have been likelier to give a right answer. If one went simply by these instances, one might assume that high intelligence and bad military judgment always go together. However, it is not so simple as that. The English intelligentsia, on the whole, were more defeatist than the mass of the people, and some of them went on being defeatist at a time when the war was quite plainly won, partly because they were better able to visualize the dreary years of warfare that lay ahead. Their morale was worse because their imaginations were stronger. The quickest way of ending a war is to lose it, and if one finds the prospect of a long war intolerable, it is natural to disbelieve in the possibility of victory. But there was more to it than that. There was also the disaffectation of large numbers of intellectuals, which made it difficult for them not to side with any country hostile to Britain. And deepest of all, there was admiration, though only in a very few cases conscience admiration, for the power, energy, and cruelty of the Nazi regime. It would be useful, but a tedious labor, to go through the left-wing press and enumerate all the hostile references to Nazism during the years 1935 to 45. One would find, I have little doubt, that they reached their high water mark in 1937-38 and 44-45, and dropped off noticeably in the years 1939 to 42. That is, during a period when Germany seemed to be winning. One would find also the same people advocating a compromise peace in 1940 and approving the dismemberment of Germany in 1945. And if one studied the reactions of the English intelligentsia towards the USSR, there too one would find genuinely progressive impulses mixed up with admiration for power and cruelty. It would be grossly unfair to suggest that power worship is the only motive for Russophile feeling, but it is one motive, and among intellectuals, it is probably the strongest one. Power worship blurs political judgment because it leads, almost unavoidably, to the belief that present trends will continue. Whoever is winning at the moment will always seem to be invincible. Remember that, U.S. citizens. If the Japanese have conquered South Asia, then they will keep South Asia forever. If the Germans have captured Tobruk, they will infallibly capture Cairo. If the Russians are in Berlin, it will not be long before they are in London, and so on. This habit of mind leads also to the belief that things will happen more quickly, completely, and catastrophically than they ever do in practice. The rise and fall of empires, the disappearance of cultures and religions are expected to happen with earthquake suddenness, and processes which have barely started are talked about as though they were already at an end. Burnham's writings are full of apocalyptic visions. Nations, governments, classes, and social systems are constantly described as expanding, contracting, decaying, dissolving, toppling, crashing, crumbling, crystallizing, and, in general, behaving in an unstable and melodramatic way. Heck of a sentence. The slowness of historical change, the fact that any epoch always contains a great deal of the last epoch, is never sufficiently allowed for. Such a manner of thinking is bound to lead to mistaken prophecies, because even when it gauges the direction of events rightly, it will miscalculate their tempo. Within the space of 5 years, Burnham foretold the domination of Russia by Germany and of Germany by Russia. In each case, he was obeying the same instinct, the instinct to bow down before the conqueror of the moment, to accept the existing trend as irreversible. With this in mind, one can criticize his theory in a broader way. The mistakes I have pointed out do not disprove Burnham's theory, but they do cast light on his probable reasons for holding it. In this connection, one cannot leave out of account the fact that Burnham is an American. Every political theory has a certain regional tinge about it, and every nation, every culture, has its own characteristic prejudices and patches of ignorance. There are certain problems that must almost inevitably be seen in a different perspective according to the geographical situation from which one is looking at them. Now, the attitude that Burnham adopts of classifying communism and fascism is much the same thing, and at much the same time accepting both of them, or at any rate not assuming that either must be violently struggled against, is essentially an American attitude, and would be almost impossible for an Englishman or any other Western European. English writers who consider communism and fascism to be the same thing invariably hold that both are monstrous evils which must be fought to the death. On the other hand, any Englishman who believes communism and fascism to be opposites will feel that he ought to side with one or the other. Under note 3, it says, the reason for this difference of outlook is simple enough, and as usual, is bound up with wish thinking. If totalitarianism triumphs and the dreams of the geopoliticians come true, Britain will disappear as a world power, and the whole of Western Europe will be swallowed by some single great state. This is not a prospect that is easy for an Englishman to contemplate with detachment. The only we're alive now. Either he does not want Britain to disappear, in which case he will tend to construct theories proving the thing that he wants, or, like a minority of intellectuals, he will decide that this country is finished and transfer his allegiance to some foreign power. An American does not have to make the same choice. Whatever happens, the United States will survive as a great power, and from the Russian point of view, it does not make much difference whether Europe is dominated by Russia or by Germany. Most Americans who think of the matter at all would prefer to see the world divided between two or three monster states, which had reached their natural boundaries and could bargain with one another on economic issues without being troubled by ideological differences. Such a world picture fits in with the American tendency to admire size for its own sake and to feel that success constitutes justification, and it fits in with the all-prevailing anti-British sentiment. In practice, Britain and the United States have twice been forced into alliance against Germany, and will probably, before long, be forced into an alliance against Russia. But subjectively, a majority of Americans would either prefer Russia or Germany to Britain, and as between Russia and Germany, would prefer whichever seems stronger at the moment. And then there's the insertion of note 4, and we'll read this later. It is therefore not surprising that Burnham's worldview should often be noticeably close to that of the American imperialists on the one side or to that of the isolationists on the other. It is a tough or realistic worldview which fits in with the American form of wish-thinking. The almost open admiration for Nazi methods which Burnham shows in the earlier of his two books and which would seem shocking to almost any English reader depends ultimately on the fact that the Atlantic is wider than the Channel. As I have said earlier, Burnham has probably been more right than wrong about the present and the immediate past. For quite 50 years past, the general drift has almost certainly been towards oligarchy. The ever-increasing concentration of industrial and financial power, the diminishing importance of the individual capitalist or shareholder, and the growth of the new managerial class of scientists, technicians, and bureaucrats, the weakness of the proletariat against a centralized state, the increasing helplessness of small countries against big ones, the decay of representative institutions and the appearance of one-party regimes based on police terrorism, that's interesting, faked plebiscites, etc. All these things seem to point in the same direction. Burnham sees the trend and assumes that it is irresistible, rather as a rabbit fascinated by a boa constrictor might assume that a boa constrictor is the strongest thing in the world. When one looks a little deeper, one sees that all his ideas rest upon two axioms, which are taken for granted in the earlier book and made partly explicit in the second one. They are, politics is essentially the same in all ages. Political behavior is different from other kinds of behavior. To take the second point first, in the Machiavellians, Burnham insists that politics is simply the struggle for power. Every great social movement, every war, every revolution, every political program, however edifying and utopian, really has behind it the ambitions of some sectional group which is out to grab power for itself. Power can never be restrained by any ethical or religious code, but only by other power. The nearest possible approach to altruistic behavior is the perception by a ruling group that it will probably stay in power longer if it does behave decently. But curiously enough, These generalizations only apply to political behavior, not to any other kind of behavior. In everyday life, as Burnham sees and admits, one cannot explain every human action by applying the principle of quo bono, who benefits. Obviously, human beings have impulses which are not selfish. Man, therefore, is an animal that can act morally when he acts as an individual, but becomes unmoral when he acts collectively. But even this generalization only holds good for the higher groups. The masses, it seems, have vague aspirations towards liberty and human brotherhood, which are easily played upon by power-hungry individuals or minorities, so that history consists of a series of swindles in which the masses are first lured into revolt by the promise of utopia, and then when they have done their job, enslaved over again by new masters. Amen. One more time. So that history consists of a series of swindles in which the masses are first lured into revolt by the promise of utopia, and then, when they have done their job, enslaved over again by new masters. Political activity, therefore, is a special kind of behavior, characterized by its complete unscrupulousness and occurring only among small groups of the population, especially among dissatisfied groups whose talents do not get free play under the existing form of society. The great mass of the people, and this is where number two ties up with number one, will always be unpolitical. In effect, therefore, humanity is divided into two classes, the self-seeking hypocritical minority and the brainless mob whose destiny is always to be led or driven, as one gets a pig, back to the sty by kicking it on the bottom or rattling a stick inside a swill bucket, according to the needs of the moment. And this beautiful pattern is to continue forever. Individuals may pass from one category to another. Whole classes may destroy other classes and rise to the dominant position. But the division of humanity into rulers and ruled is unalterable. In their capabilities, as in their desires and needs, men are not equal. There is an iron law of oligarchy, which would operate even if democracy were not impossible for mechanical reasons. It is curious that in all his talk about the struggle for power, Burnham never stops to ask why people want power. He seems to assume that power hunger, although only dominant in comparatively few people, is a natural instinct that does not have to be explained, like the desire for food. He also assumes that the division of society into classes serves the same purpose in all ages. This is practically to ignore the history of hundreds of years. When Burnham's master, Machiavelli, was writing, class divisions were not only unavoidable, but desirable. So long as methods of production were primitive, the great mass of the people were necessarily tied down to dreary, exhausting manual labor. And a few people had to be set free from such labor, otherwise civilization could not maintain itself, let alone make any progress. But since the arrival of the machine, the whole pattern has altered. The justification for class distinctions, if there is a justification, is no longer the same, because there is no mechanical reason why the average human being should continue to be a drudge. True, drudgery persists. Class distinctions are probably reestablishing themselves in a new form, and individual liberty is on the downgrade. But as these developments are now technically avoidable, they must have some psychological cause which Burnham makes no attempt to discover. The question that he ought to ask, and never does ask, is, why does the lust for naked power become a major human motive exactly now, when the dominion of man over man is ceasing to be necessary? As for the claim that human nature or inexorable laws of this and that make socialism impossible, is simply a projection of the past into the future. In effect, Burnham argues that because a society of free and equal human beings has never existed, it can never exist. By the same argument, one could have demonstrated the impossibility of aeroplanes in 1900 or of motor cars in 1950. Make that 1850, sorry about that. The notion that the machine has altered human relationships, and that in consequence Machiavelli is out of date, is a very obvious one. If Burnham fails to deal with it, it can, I think, only be because his own power instinct leads him to brush aside any suggestion that the Machiavellian world of force, fraud, and tyranny may somehow come to an end. It is important to bear in mind what I said above, that Burnham's theory is only a variant, an American variant, and interesting because of its comprehensiveness, of the power worship now so prevalent among intellectuals. A more normal variant, at any rate in England, is communism, if one examines the people who, having some idea of what the Russian regime is like, are strongly Russophile, one finds that, on the whole, they belong to the managerial class of which Burnham writes. That is, they are not managers in the narrow sense, but scientists, technicians, teachers, journalists, broadcasters, bureaucrats, professional politicians, In general, middling people who feel themselves cramped by a system that is still partly aristocratic and are hungry for more power and more prestige. These people look toward the USSR and see in it, or think they see, a system which eliminates the upper class, keeps the working class in its place, and hands unlimited power to people very similar to themselves. It was only after the Soviet regime became unmistakably totalitarian that English intellectuals, in large numbers, began to show an interest in it. Burnham, although the English Russophile intelligentsia would repudiate him, is really voicing their secret wish, the wish to destroy the old equalitarian, and that's what it says here, equalitarian version of socialism, and usher in a hierarchical society where the intellectual can at last get his hands on the whip. Burnham, at least, has the honesty to say that socialism isn't coming. The others merely say that socialism is coming, and then give the word socialism a new meaning which makes nonsense of the old one. But his theory, for all its appearance of objectivity, is the rationalization of a wish. There is no strong reason for thinking that tells us anything about the future except perhaps the immediate future. It merely tells us what kind of world the managerial class themselves, or at least the more conscious and ambitious members of the class, would like to live in. Now, I don't mean to belabor this with any comments, but it's come to my mind when he says, there's no strong reason for thinking that it tells us anything about the future, except perhaps the immediate future. And here's Orwell, who wrote 84. I'm not saying this is a contradiction. Just find an interesting statement for him to make in 46, when he proceeds to tell us exactly what's in the cooker and what's coming down the pike a half century before it did. Fortunately, the managers are not so invincible as Burnham believes. It is curious how persistently in the managerial revolution he ignores the advantages, military as well as social, enjoyed by a democratic country. At every point, the evidence is squeezed in order to show the strength, vitality, and durability of Hitler's crazy regime. Germany is expanding rapidly, and rapid territorial expansion has always been a sign, not of decadence, but of renewal. Germany makes war successfully, and the ability to make war well is never a sign of decadence, but of its opposite. Germany also inspires in millions of persons a fanatical loyalty. This too never accompanies decadence. Even the cruelty and dishonesty of the Nazi regime are cited in its favor, since the young new rising social order is, as against the old, more likely to resort on a large scale to lies, terror, persecution. Yet within only 5 years, this young new rising social order had smashed itself to pieces and become, in Burnham's usage of the word, decadent. And this had happened quite largely because of the managerial, that is, undemocratic structure, which Burnham admires. The immediate cause of the German defeat was the unheard-of folly of attacking the USSR while Britain was still undefeated and America was manifestly getting ready to fight. All right, so the cause of defeat was the folly of attacking Russia with Britain undefeated and with America getting ready to jump in, which I think goes to show you that that was a scripted event. And all those mistakes were mistakes built into it. Mistakes of this magnitude can only be made, or at any rate, they are most likely to be made, in countries where public opinion has no power. So long as the common man can get a hearing, such elementary rules as not fighting all your enemies simultaneously are less likely to be violated. But, in any case, one should have been able to see from the start that such a movement as Nazism could not produce any good or stable result. Actually, so long as they were winning, Burnham seems to have been seeing nothing wrong with the methods of the Nazis. Such methods, he says, only appear wicked because they are new. And here's a quote. There is no historical law that polite manners and justice shall conquer. In history, there is always the question of whose manners and whose justice. A rising social class and a new order of society have got to break through the old moral codes, just as they must break through the old economic and political institutions. Naturally, from the point of view of the old, they are monsters. If they win, they take care in due time of manners and morals. The end of the quote. This implies that literally anything can become right or wrong if the dominant class in the moment so wills it. It ignores the fact that certain rules of conduct have to be observed if human society is to hold together at all. Burnham, therefore, was unable to see the crimes and follies of the Nazi regime must lead, by one route or another, to disaster. So also with this newfound admiration for Stalin. It is too early to say in just what way the Russian regime will destroy itself. If I had to make a prophecy, I should say that a continuation of the Russian policies of the last 15 years, an internal and external policy, of course, are merely two facets of the same thing, and it can only lead to a war conducted with atomic bombs, which will make Hitler's invasion look like a tea party. But at any rate, the Russian regime will either democratize itself or it will perish. The huge, invincible, everlasting slave empire which Burnham appears to dream will not be established, or, get established will not endure because slavery is no longer a stable basis for human society. I just find that very interesting about what he says, because World War II is over. And this harkens back somewhat to what he wrote in that book, Inside the Book, in 1984, when it says, "If I had to make a prophecy, I should say that a continuation of the Russian policies of the last 15 years," now here's a long dashed off parenthetical statement, "and internal and external policy, of course, are merely two facets of the same thing." End of that phrase. Okay? "Can only lead to a war conducted with atomic bombs, which will make Hitler's invasion look like a tea party." Would you do well to remember those words for what is coming for us? And lastly, one cannot always make positive prophecies, but there are times when one ought to be able to make negative ones. No one could have been expected to foresee the exact results of the Treaty of Versailles, but millions of thinking people could and did foresee that those results would be bad. Plenty of people, though not so many in this case, can foresee that the results of the settlement now being forced on Europe will also be bad. And to refrain from admiring Hitler or Stalin, that too should not require an enormous intellectual effort. But it is partly a normal effort, a moral effort, rather, that a man of Burnham's gifts should have been able for a while to think of Nazism as something rather admirable, something that could and probably would build up a workable and durable social order, shows what damage is done to the sense of reality by the cultivation of what is now called realism. And that's the end of the essay. Now, here are the four notes that were built into the body of this essay. Note one. It is difficult to think of any politician who has lived to be 80 and still been regarded as a success. What we call a great statesman normally means one who dies before his policy has had time to take effect. If Cromwell had lived a few years longer, he probably would have fallen from power, in which case we should now regard him as a failure. If Pétain had died in 1930, France would have venerated him as a hero and patriot. Napoleon remarked once that if only a cannonball had happened to hit him when he was riding into Moscow, he would have gone down to history as the greatest man who ever lived. Note 2. Great Britain raised 1 million volunteers in the earlier part of the 1914 to 1918 war. This must be a world's record, but the pressures applied were such that it is doubtful whether the recruitment ought to be described as voluntary. Even the most ideological wars have been fought largely by pressed men. In the English Civil War, the Napoleonic Wars, the American Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, etc., both sides resorted to conscription or the press gang. Note 3. The only exception I am able to think of is Bernard Shaw, who for some years at any rate declared communism and fascism to be much the same thing and was in favor of both of them. But Shaw, after all, is not an Englishman and probably does not feel his fate to be bound up with that of Britain. But you have to remember, too, that Shaw wrote The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, in which he writes in the epilogue that he sees a world, a socialistic world, where people, as he said, will be forcibly fed and clothed and housed and given jobs, and if they did not have the industry, I think he said, to be able to prevail in that society, they could be executed in a kindly manner. I don't care if he's British or not. These guys all shared the same sentiments. I don't mean Orwell and Shaw, but the group from which Orwell found himself outed, and that's the Fabian Socialists. And the last note, to me, I don't care what you call it, communism, socialism, fascism. To me, isn't communism fascism? Yes. Is communism socialism? Yeah, but I think making it even more draconian. And I think a lot of days what people are talking about being socialism is actually communism, which was not cooked up by Marx and Engels, but by the same old bankers and everyone else, the capitalists, the financiers, who decided that one day this is the way the world would be run. Capitalism without competition is communism. Or as they like to say, monopoly capitalist. Okay, that's fine, whatever you want. As late as autumn of 1945, a Gallup poll taken among American troops in Germany showed that 51% thought Hitler did much good before 1939. This was after 5 years of anti-Hitler propaganda. The verdict, as quoted, is not very strongly favorable to Germany, but it is hard to believe that a verdict equally favorable to Britain would be given by anywhere near 51% of the American army. It's a lot to digest. I think that's an excellent, excellent essay, not because I always think Orwell's right, but just for the information that got out there, and also for taking another look at James Burnham, a character that we've all kind of forgotten about. And I think what Burnham was espousing also is not so much an American view, but what we might see as the seeds, the roots of the neocon world in which we live now. So if you're wondering how we ever got this way, and, you know, this crosses lines, too. This is more, I mean, this is not only about Republicans. It's about Republicans and Democrats. It doesn't matter. They approach the situation a little differently, but they still are in the same Trotskyite arena. And I think that's where you can see how it got its start. If not before World War II, certainly after World War II, when Kennan and Burnham and these characters started to pick around national policy and sell it to subsequent generations. So anyway, that's it. That is the Orwell essay, James Burnham and the Managerial Revolution, from New English Weekly, May 1946. If you want to read anything about Burnham, on my website, go down to where it says, I think, the first neocon or the first Trotskyite or something like that. I forget what it says, but it's the first article that you come down to when you pass the current shows and such. It's a three-parter on Burnham. I think it's very revealing about that those times. A lot of us don't think too much about post-World War II America and the politics at the time. Little murky, you know, going from 45 maybe to 60. A lot of people started paying attention, obviously, with the appearance of Kennedy. Many of you were never alive at that time, and I don't know what kind of treatment it got in history books or the books that you happen to read. But a lot of stuff went down, I think, very, very surreptitiously between 45 and 55. And I think it bears another look back at Joe McCarthy and just exactly who were good guys and bad guys there. And I think Burnham showing himself supposedly as a staunch anti-communist was, in fact, a communist, or at least somebody who embraced the idea of the world that we're going to, which will be communistic in nature. All right, that's it, like I said. Sorry to go on so long. Also, if you want to read this for yourself, go back to it or print it out in case it disappears. I know it's on a site devoted to Orwell. I thank the listener who sent it to me. I did not, when I did a copy and paste, I guess I did it in a Word doc, and I did not bring the URL over with me. But if you do a search on, you know, Orwell plus James Burnham, which is spelled Burnham, you know, plus Managerial Revolution, this thing should come right up, and you will have at it. It may also be in more than just one spot. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you revisit this sometime, because I think whether Orwell was positive or negative about Burnham or whatever, that the information he put out there, regardless of Burnham's cause, regardless why Burnham said what he did, stated what he did, backed what he did, still I see that is what is happening today. And I've restated it about seven times now. I'll see you later. Bye-bye.